Hello again to all of you, and a special welcome to those who are joining Teleclass Education for the first time. My name is Paul Weber, and today it is my honor to introduce Denise Murphy and her Teleclass lecture, Eliminating Preventable Harm Through Building a Reliable Culture of Safety. To give a comprehensive review of Denise's distinguished career would take far too long, so let me just hit a very few highlights. Denise Murphy entered the field of infection prevention and control in 1981, way back then, and has been an epidemiologist in hospitals ranging from 100 to as many as 1,200 beds. She is Vice President for Quality and Patient Safety at Mainline Health System, which is a network of five hospitals in Philadelphia. She was the president of APIC in 2007 and received the very prestigious Carol DeMille Achievement Award in 2010. She is a member of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's Hospital Infection Control Practice Advisory Committee, or HICPAC, and SHAE's Patient Safety Committee. She's also authoring the Patient Safety Chapter for ASHRM's Risk Management Handbook for Healthcare Organizations. It's safe to say, I think, that our speaker is a leader in the field, perhaps the leader in the field of quality and patient safety, and it is a great delight for me to be able to introduce her today to present Eliminating Preventable Harm Through Building a Reliable Culture of Safety. I give you Denise Murphy. Denise.
It's really a pleasure to be talking about something that has become probably the most near and dear thing to my heart, and that is reliability and culture of safety. Because whether you're doing infection prevention, if you're doing quality, patient safety and risk management, if you're doing patient care or managing patient care at the bedside, culture is really probably the most important fundamental element of our success in trying to do the right thing for patients and keep them from harm. So that takes us, I'm going to breeze by the objectives, right to slide three. What do our patients expect from us? Of course, that we won't hurt them, that we'll help them, and that we'll be nice to them. And the patient experience has become very high on the radar screen of healthcare executives all over at least the United States, because of the emphasis being put on that by CMS and through their whole value-based purchasing project. And if you think back to public reporting and the controversy that surrounded public reporting of infection rates for so many years, one of the good things that that has done, it's driven some standardization, and it really has made it very high on everyone's radar screen, from the public through the members of boards that really provide the leadership for our healthcare management. So if you go on to the next slide, a very important question, and really what this will be about, is also what employees expect from us. And they expect for leaders to provide them with an environment that is safe, where there's good process design, and where people are accountable for safe behaviors. And all of that together results in reliability. The other thing that employees expect is that when things go wrong, that there will be a just response or a fair response to an error. So just culture is about not punishing human error, but instead looking at behavioral accountability and then looking to find where there might be system problems that are setting people up to create errors that may lead to harm, both to the patient and then to what we often refer to as the second victim, which is the healthcare professional that is involved in a harm event. So going on to the next slide, number five, just a couple of brief points about culture. I think everyone knows what culture is. It's really based on beliefs, values, and principles that shape the way individuals behave. And it's often the unspoken way we do things around here. And you can't see culture, but you can see it. Well, you can see it, but it's usually not written down. The thing about culture is you feel it when you push against it. So if you are a new staff nurse and you're an extrovert and you're used to speaking up about things that concern you, you're going to know pretty quickly when everyone on your team starts to look at you like you're crazy because you're actually bringing up concerns and talking about risk openly, you might start to realize that you're in a hierarchical culture where people just sweep that stuff under the rug and don't talk about it. Culture is generally set by leaders, but it often will arise from the front line and can be a grassroots acknowledgement of things that just don't feel right to staff. Culture takes a long time to change, and the way you know that culture is changing is that when you see that people are doing the very safest thing, when no one is observing, no one is watching and auditing them, they're doing the right thing because that's what they know is best for patients, and that's what feels, that's what their values are about, is doing the right thing at all times. The next slide begins to talk a little bit about reliability science, and you know, I've looked at a lot of different and complex definitions of reliability, and it's basically about the understanding of how humans perform in complex systems, and their human performance is really what lends to the methods of creating human error, and we'll get a little more into that. But building reliability into systems must be done intentionally. This is about making it easier for humans to do the right thing and harder for them to make mistakes. So if you go to the next cute little slide where we've got the mouse with the helmet on looking at the cheese that's sitting in the mouse trap, you know, we can see that safety has to be designed intentionally. We can't leave it to chance. So when we take high-risk situations and we add high-risk behaviors, then the chance of an event of harm is going to become much higher. So let's go to the next slide and talk about what some industries have done to build reliability, and now I'm talking about slide 8, where it says reliability synergy. What have some industries done way better than we have? Well, if you look at the logs on the side, 10 to the third is where we would pretty much put healthcare. And what does that mean? About 1 in 1,000 opportunities or patient interactions, we can experience some level of error or some type of adverse or undesired event. Now, how did we get that good? Well, good process design by evidence-based best practices. So if you look at, for example, in infection prevention and control, the bundles. We have a bundle to prevent CLABSI and CALDI and surgical site infections and so on. And so by doing that and by putting some technology enablers in place, and that can be everything from dressings to large drapes and CHG preps and so on, you know, the technology is trying to follow the evidence and help us be able to protect people from harm. And it's still resulting in only a 10 to the third reliability. If we were to go way off the scale here, the airline industry is about 10 to the 7th. So that means that 1 in 10 million takeoffs will result in a plane crash. If we were to go even further and look at the nuclear industry, 1 in 100 million opportunities for a nuclear accident will actually occur. And how do they do that? How do they actually build such reliability into their systems? Because they take that work in good process design and they couple it with behavioral accountability. So a lot of what we're going to talk about in today's session is around that behavioral accountability, and where we set expectations for certain behaviors, we give people what they need to meet our expectations, and then we hold them accountable. So that's where we're going to get into some of the specifics that we've learned on our journey at Mainline Health and some of the ways that we have absolutely been able to get very far along that journey on eliminating preventable harm. So if you look at the next slide, and I'm up to number 9, it says complementary strategies. So basically what this shows is that in healthcare, we tend to improve care in silos. We have our CLABSI prevention team, and we have our surgical site infection prevention team. We might have hand hygiene teams and fall prevention teams and the rapid response teams and so on. And they're all working in isolation. And I'm sure that some of you have heard that if you were to take the VAP prevention team and the elevation of the head of the bed and then look at the fact that, especially in high-risk patients in places like ICUs, they can be sliding and shearing their skin. And so a conversation between the VAP team and the the pressure ulcer prevention team is pretty important in really looking at reliability in terms of how do we prevent all bad things from happening to our patients. But for the most part, we try to operate in improvement silos. But underlying all of that is culture. And if we don't address culture, any changes that we make will not be sustainable. They might be around for a little while, but they won't last, because reliability and having that kind of cultural attitude of continuous improvement and always looking, being uncomfortable about risk and about harm, is a cultural thing. It's not a bundle. It's really about the behaviors, or what I call the people bundle. If we go to slide 10, the approach to transformational culture change. We learned this approach by working with, and I have the source listed below, Healthcare Performance Improvement out of Virginia Beach. We began working with them in late 2009, and I'll get a little bit into our reliability journey in just a minute. But they say that the approach to transformational change should really be by looking at three particular strategies. One, always set very clear expectations. Expectations should be behavioral-based. And they are looking for event-free performance, so meaning bad event-free performance. The second thing is that you provide the education, the tools, the training, and opportunities for staff to build their skills based on the expectations you've set. And then three is reinforcing and building accountability. That means at every level in the organization, we're holding people accountable for safe behaviors. And we build in checks and balances and auditing and conversations and rounds until these behaviors actually become habit. So if we go on to slide 11, building reliable culture, I want to start to share with you a little bit about our journey at Mainline Health. And the first part of this will be making the case for change. And those of you that know me know that I've talked about the business case my entire career, because there's so many competing priorities for healthcare executives that there's got to be a pretty good case for why we're going to really invest in serious change. So if you go into slide 12, the Mainline Health diagnostic was done in the fall between September and December of 2009, with our results shared in early 2010. We did the diagnostic by doing a deep dive into 73 serious patient safety events that resulted in harm in the previous couple of years. We also did direct interviews and focus groups with about 565 staff and physicians. And then we did review of documents and our data, and we toured facilities looking at specific behavioral observations. We were looking at how doctors and nurses spoke to each other. We were asking some questions in the focus groups, and then, you know, about how do people interact. And then we were on the units watching to see if those interactions were really happening the way the staff described. And then we looked at data from the 2009 AHRQ, Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the safety culture survey, and we lined that up with our Gallup employee engagement surveys that also have a few questions in it about patient safety. So let's go to the next slide, number 13. And all of the things that we looked at when we dug into our 73 events of harm were to try and categorize these events and to look at where we could identify behavioral types of errors. Were they knowledge-based errors? And knowledge-based errors were errors that were made when performing acts related to something new or unfamiliar, which required problem solving, and a rule didn't exist for it. And then we looked at skill-based errors, which are those kind of autopilot things that we're taught to do. So, for example, using a seatbelt is a skill-based behavior. And if you got in the car and you didn't remember to automatically connect your seatbelt, then that would be a skill-based error. And that's really the smallest, you know, those autopilot kind of errors are the smallest number of errors that we saw. And the most that we saw were rule-based, and that's kind of the if-then response. So if I see a yellow light, then I speed up or slow down, which would really be the right thing to do. But the if-then rule-based kind of errors are really the errors where lack of compliance very seriously comes into play. So if you look at slide number 14, for our particular diagnostic, we saw that the events of harm that we were able to drill into when we looked at individual and system causes of these events, we saw that the majority of them fit into two categories, the critical thinking, or really lack thereof, and compliance. That was largely what the two areas were. And in your appendix at the end of the slide set, you have some definitions that really spell out what do we mean by critical thinking, what do we mean by attention to detail or normalized deviance, and so on. Now, communication may shock you at 6.6%, and that's because so much of the communication, when we think broadly about communication, so much of that falls into the bucket of critical thinking, and actually compliance as well, but largely critical thinking. So going to the next slide, some more data from Mainline Health, and many of your organizations may also have taken part in these surveys, that we saw that we had some pretty surprisingly low scores. So our overall mean composite score was only 61% in 2010 when we did the survey, and it bumped up to 62% as our overall composite in 2012. Now, you know, it's pretty sad that when you look at the national and regional averages, we're actually pretty much right there. So as a nation, we're not doing very well. According to our staff, when we ask questions about our safety culture, one of the things that's particularly frightening on this slide is when you look down, it's item number 4, handoffs and transitions. We were statistically better than the nation and the region in handoffs and transitions, and yet only 45% of our staff answered that they thought we did handoffs and transitions in patient care safely. So we as a nation have a lot to do. I believe that in other countries they would probably say the same. But using this type of survey results and looking for, in fact, we are about to in March embark on our 2014 AHRQ safety culture and are very much hoping that our scores have gone up. And our Gallup scores that we just received back, we took that survey in August and September, those scores have shown that there was about a 3% overall improvement in all of the areas. Even though the scoring for the Gallup is a little bit different, generally higher, we certainly are improving in all of the areas of patient safety. When you look at the next slide on your set, that's number 16. Another thing that we've done at Mainline for the last many years is crucial conversations working with a company called Vital Smarts. And when asked, this is managers, these data in front of you are 2 years of manager training. Okay, so since 2009 and 2010 through 2013, we've been going through 10,000 staff members. But when we did the managers, we were horrified to see that, for example, you know, in 2008, less than 50% of managers would speak up if they saw someone break rules or take dangerous shortcuts. But even more frightening, if you look down to make a mistake, at the time, only 25 to 38% of our managers were willing to speak up when they saw someone make a mistake. So very kind of frightening data. And when you put all this together, if you go to slide number 17, it won't surprise you to see that on the second bullet, in overall in our diagnostic, we saw that culture accounts for more than 70% of the system causes that led to patient harm or death, and specifically related to the two things I noted previously, lack of critical thinking and lack of compliance with safe documented practices. I'm going to get into something and describe in a little more detail for you what power distance and authority gradient is about. And it exists in most practice areas and was surely a problem in many of our practice areas, in some of our ICUs, among particular surgical services. We really saw a real power distance and authority gradient. So if you go to the next slide, number 18, basically we were, they felt that the organization was poised and ready to take on some serious transformational work in culture. One of the key messages is that the medical staff really needed to not just support but actively participate in the culture change. and that our safety behaviors for preventing errors would focus on those areas where we saw most of our harm events occurring, starting with questioning attitude and critical thinking through effective handoffs, and then certainly the list goes on and ends with how do we get staff to communicate in the presence of and a power distance and authority gradient? How do we help empower them to speak up when they feel like it's kind of frightening to be low on the food chain because you're the people that are listened to the least, or if you speak up, you're the people that could be punished? If you look on the next slide, which in your deck is number 19, the data on the bottom is simply a cut from our AHRQ survey, where staff, the last question, staff feel free to question the decisions of those with more authority. In both the year 2010, which is our bottom bars, and the year 2012, which are the bars that sit on top, in 2010, 44% of the time, and in 2012, only 47% of the time, did staff feel that most of the time or always would they speak up to someone with more authority. So it's really frightening to think that less than 50% of your staff, you know, will be willing to speak up. And equally as frightening are the bars that are closest to the question there, 24 and 27% said that they would rarely or never speak up to someone with more authority. So that message out to our management and our leadership and our medical staff was really frightening because, you know, people would say, oh, no one's afraid of me. Are you kidding? Everyone speaks up to me. Well, these data really showed us that our perceptions were absolutely wrong. So all of the data that you saw supported the need for real transformational change. But on the next slide, these data are really what engaged people. This was our story and our call to action. And although you have a sample report here with fictional names, we actually would start all of our meetings in silence, in the dark, and one at a time, the real names of patients would come up with the date that they were either harmed or died on under our care. And I can tell you that when we first did this in 2010, and we had to sit and look at close to 30 names scroll onto the screen, it was so uncomfortable that everyone in the group, I think, really had, because, you know, we have great outcomes, great reputation, and so no one realized that all these people were being harmed on our watch. So going to slide number 21. We set a goal in 2013. We set annual goals, and then we set long-term goals that the entire organization, including the board, who will get active in the organization, go out and observe and make rounds, we set the goal that there would be a 50% reduction in harm by June of 2013. So you might ask, 50%? Like, is that really okay when, you know, if you had 30 people harmed, it's okay to say we'll harm 15. That's a pretty good score. That's not at all the discussion that we had. But one of the things that we said was since we had to undertake transformational change in order to create a reliable culture that would last, we were going to have to spend the next couple of years building infrastructure and making changes that were so drastic in the way we did care every day and in our behaviors, especially, you know, including our leadership behaviors for reliability, that we thought that a 50% reduction, frankly, we were actually worried that we wouldn't make it. But of course, we also stated that we would reduce harm by 50% year over year until we reached zero events of harm and sustained zero for at least, you know, every 12-month period. So going on to organizing for culture change, some of the strategies, tools, and infrastructure, this is important if you're thinking, well, what does that mean? How does an organization commit to and actually start to take steps to change their culture? So on slide 23, you see that that leadership, really, it's an evolution. So you have to go from doing things because the Joint Commission or CMS says you have to do them, to making safety the absolute core value in the organization that cannot be compromised for anything. It's the priority that won't be compromised for finances. It won't be compromised for any reason. And instead of just saying we're creating a safety culture, we had to realize that we were shaping a culture of reliability that put safety first. So reliability was a science that we didn't know a lot about as clinicians, and that we were going to have to adopt some practices from industries that did this better than we did. Our board and senior leaders and our medical staff needed to own and manage and promote the safety culture instead of, quote, supporting it and letting those of us who wore badges that said safety or infection prevention or quality, you know, the typical people that everyone in the organization looks to, including, you know, our nursing and other management, but that they actually, each one of them, would be asked to do things differently. And so when our presidents were going in on night shift and walking through the error prevention tools with staff and asking them if they could describe them and describe a way that they might be able to use them, and that they were coming in at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday, this was real visible commitment and the beginning of culture change. On slide 24, I get into a little bit about power distance and authority gradient. And the formal definitions and the source of this information, which is a wonderful book, High Reliability Organizations by Wyck and Sutcliffe. Instead of going through the formal, description here, I'll just sort of say what the informal description is. And this is about the food chain and where you sit in the food chain or the hierarchy of the organization. So this is where the people that have less power really accept that power is distributed unequally, and that's okay. So if I'm a patient care tech in an operating room or a surgical scrub tech, that I get it that the circulating nurse is more powerful than me and the surgeon is more powerful than them, so I don't really speak up to these people. And it's unbelievable how alive and well this power distance and authority gradient is in healthcare organizations. And the only way that you can start to break that down is to educate about it, to give examples of where it's happening, to talk about how dangerous it is to patient safety, and then to begin to create an organizational culture where this power gradient is reduced, because you are actually giving everyone, no matter what their title or where they are in the hierarchy of the organization, the power to speak up for safety. So the next two slides, actually, if I were clicking these with a clicker, on the first slide, you just see that we had to set up several different leadership teams, our safety culture leadership team that reported up to the senior executive or the senior leadership team. The physician leadership team were the chiefs and the chairs and the medical directors and all the people with formal titles. And then we realized that the most important aspect of all of these leaders would be our safety coaches that worked on the front line. They were members of the staff on every unit and in every department, and there's a little bit of a description of what the safety coaches actually do toward the end. So let's click now and get to slide 27, curriculum development and training. This isn't really that important, except to know that all this demonstrates is that there were hundreds of people that were involved in many sessions over the course of a year getting us ready to launch our curriculum. We worked closely with HPI. We got a lot of materials from them that we chose to revise and make them our own to fit our culture and the type of language we used. We selected and trained about 150 trainers, because this is all rolled out through a train-the-trainer program. And then we actually spent 12 months training all of our leadership, our board, our managers and directors, and then we began on the staff and physician training. On the next slide, which is 28, all of the training was aimed at the three ways in which humans perform: the skill-based, role-based, and knowledge-based performance. The next slide is facts about human errors, which I'm not going to take time to read. I just want to mention that the most important messages that we continue to communicate over and over was that everyone, even the best and brightest, no matter how experienced you were, no matter how deep your knowledge and experience went, everyone that is a human being will eventually make a very serious error, and that we can avoid most errors by practicing low-risk behaviors. So the next slide gets into listing what some of these behaviors are, and I'll start with our reliability culture toolkit for leaders. These are the things that everyone who's in a supervisory capacity of any kind had to demonstrate, and we had to learn it in classroom setting. We had to practice it. We had to coach each other. We did a lot of role modeling, and that role modeling still goes on today. In fact, all of the leadership assemblies at hospitals have no longer been, we no longer have senior leaders run those assemblies each month. We have a team of two managers from different departments or supervisors or educators and coordinators that will lead the whole leadership assembly, and they not only start with a patient safety story, but they will often do a role play so that they're actually modeling for everyone how they have begun to use reliability tools as leaders. So our three behaviors as leaders were to make safety a core value, to find and fix problems, and build and sustain accountability by using the following tools: starting every meeting with a safety topic or safety story, recognizing and supporting those who stop the line. I'll jump down to finding and fixing problems, like start the clock for safety. And building, sustaining, and accountability is done through 5-to-1 feedback. So it doesn't mean like you give somebody 5 compliments and then you nail them with a, here's what you're doing wrong. But instead, it means that you're about at a 5-to-1 ratio in terms of how you are providing positive, constant reinforcement of positive behaviors to people, so that if you do speak to them about a behavior that needs to change, that you have trust and credibility because you're picking up the fact that, you know, hey, Sally, thank you so much for always, always using our hand hygiene products. I never come on the unit without seeing you running in and out and using those hand hygiene pumps. And just constantly reinforcing the behaviors that we're looking for. And then finally, the strongest aspect of sustaining accountability are where we build things into our performance management system. So now at least throughout every quarter, our staff has to demonstrate proficiency with 4 error prevention tools, and that is part of their performance management. And our RED rules we'll talk about at the very end of the lecture, and that's something that if you use very few RED rules and they're so serious, there's such inherent risk to not using them, that there's an opportunity that someone could lose their position if they break a RED rule. So let's go on and talk just about how leaders might find and fix problems, since I don't have time to talk about our whole toolkit. One of the things that we started with was a daily check-in. So if you go to the next slide, you see where one of our trainers from HPI, Steve Kreiser, is a naval aviator. So he had a lot of stories to share with us about walking the deck and how naval aviators would walk the deck arm in arm, and they're just constantly sweeping eyes back and forth, looking for a paperclip or anything small that could be on the deck that could end up in a propeller and cause an accident. So at our hospitals, how do we walk the deck? Well, we start with daily huddle. We do a daily safety huddle at 9:30 across every mainline hospital, where all leaders and management are there for a 15-minute huddle. Usually it's in a large conference room where a lot of senior leaders can fit. If leaders are off-site or unable to attend, there's a bridge line, and they each go around and they state their name, their department, and what they have to add to the safety huddle, and then they say end of report, and the next one goes. It's like clockwork. It's amazing how quickly this happens. Safety huddles have been adopted by every patient care unit and department in the hospital, and the times differ based on the flow of patient care in that particular area. If you go to slide 33, you see the type, what a typical agenda for a safety huddle might look like. The number of days since the last preventable harm event, the number of days since our last healthcare-associated infection or fall with harm or pressure ulcer. You know, so there's a whole list of things that are reported on every morning. There are follow-ups on the previous day's actions and updates from the previous night's activity, and anything that is really actionable that requires immediate or a start-the-clock intervention is discussed. They talk about anything that's going to happen today that could impact our patient safety. Is there anything we predict in the next 24 hours that might be a risk, and anything that we have to ensure that we're doing? they talk about any great catches or great experience stories at that meeting, and all physicians and employees are actually invited to join or to share their concerns through someone that will be joining the daily huddles. And these happen on the weekends as well as during the week. If you go to the next slide on 34, Start the Clock for Safety, it just gives you an idea that there, if there's something really urgent that happens, like last week, we had a code in a procedure area, and we realized that the codes in a procedure area where you've got sort of the captain of the ship kind of people, like you've got a surgeon or something, that it happens very differently than it does out on the unit, where these are so choreographed, and our hospital medicine physicians come in, and as soon as they arrive, they take over charge of the code. It runs very, very smoothly and effectively. And then in procedure areas, we learned that depending on the area, when we did a little drill down, sometimes it's chaotic because they're not always sure, even though there's capable people in the room, who is going to manage the code. So that was our Start the Clock for Safety last week at one of our hospitals, and we also have sort of a chain that we share any Start the Clocks with the entire five-hospital organization. Moving on to slide number 35, these get into our error prevention tools. And our five safety behavioral expectations are that we will, one, pay attention to detail, two, communicate clearly, three, hand off effectively, four, speak up for safety, and five, got your back. And we will do that by practicing the following error prevention tools. So in attention to detail, we've got STAR. Hand off effectively, we've got the use of SBAR, stating things in this is the situation, let me share the background, my assessment is, and my recommendations or request are, and then that is the way that people in our organization make their information for handoff very concise and to make sure that we've got the important aspects of information that need to be shared. Speaking up for safety, I'm going to share a little bit about ARC, the tool ARC, and Got Your Back. Our two tools are peer checking and peer coaching. So let's go to STAR, which is on slide number 36. STAR is Stop, Think, Act, and Review. It literally takes about 1 to 2 seconds to focus our attention on the task at hand. We think about what we're about to do, we perform the action, and then we review to make sure that what we wanted to happen actually happened. The reason I have the Hershey bars there is because I took a snapshot of a vending machine, because this is the best example of how we use STAR every single day. If we go to a vending machine and we want M&Ms with peanuts, we will use our index finger. We will look to see that we are at D7. Okay, so in this case, I want a plain Hershey bar, whereas, you know, D9 is the Hershey with almonds. So I check D7. I take my index finger, I run it over, and I find the D and I find the 7 with my eyes. I look back to do a second check, and then I hit D7 and make sure that that Hershey bar is falling out. If only we did that when we were delivering medications and we were getting ready to do procedures, because with only the seconds it takes to do STAR, we can reduce the probability of making an error by a factor of 10 or more. If we move on to our next safety behavior, so that was about attention to detail, communicate clearly involves three error prevention tools, a three-way repeat back and readbacks, clarifying questions, and phonetic and numeric clarifications. So if you go to the next slide, a three-way repeat back is when the sender will initiate their communication. They talk about an order, request, or information in a clear and concise format, and we use the format SBAR, SBAR, situation background, assessment, and request or recommendation. Then the receiver acknowledges by repeating back the order, request, or information, and the sender will say, that's correct. So language shapes culture, and people going through these courses with us, we had to say to them, when you leave here, you can't leave this information in the room. You start immediately using three-way repeat backs, and you, if you are the person receiving the information, use the safety phrase, let me repeat that back. And then the person on the other end knows they're about to hear, you know, a confirmation of what they said, and then the sender must say, that's correct. So we have a lot of safety phrases that have really done a good job in helping us change our culture. On the next slide, number 39, it's about asking clarifying questions, which are really important in high-risk situations when we think the information might be incomplete or when it's not really clear to us and we feel confused. Asking a clarifying question can reduce the risk of error by at least 2.5 times. Our safety phrase is, I have a clarifying question. And you hear this everywhere you go in the organization. When we make rounds, we might be talking to someone near a desk or a unit secretary picks up the phone, and we are listening to hear things like, I have a clarifying question, or let me repeat that back, or that's correct. And then we know that our tools are actually being used. Let's go to the next one, which is the use of ARC, A-R-C-C. This is one of the hardest error prevention tools that we have. It's extremely uncomfortable, I think, for staff to learn to use this. This is to escalate issues with the lightest touch possible by beginning with asking a question. Second, you make a request. If you still don't get the desired action, you voice a concern. If there's still no success, you use the chain of command. Of course, if there's imminent danger to a patient, then we use the term, stop the line, I need clarity. But a good use of ARC, if you go to the next slide, I've got a couple ideas on here about ARC. But in the infection prevention world, and we have some really good video clips that demonstrate our staff using this in the case of isolation. So if you were to say, someone's coming up to, you know, go into an isolation room, the patient's on contact precautions, and of course they're not going to use a gown. Why? Well, because I'm not going to really touch the patient or anything in the room. I'm sure that most of you would be shaking your head that that's a common scenario. So you begin ARC by saying, Dr. Jones, can I help you with your isolation gown? So you've asked a question. No, it's okay, Denise. I'm not going to be in the room very long. I won't touch anything. No, Dr. Jones, I really need you to comply with our precautions, so let me help you with your gown. So I've made a request. Dr. Jones is still assuring me that it's okay to go in the room without anything, so I voice my concern. Dr. Jones, we're working very hard on reducing C. difficile in our unit. I'm concerned that if you don't comply with our precautions, that you could actually be spreading C. diff even further through our patients. Please let me help you with your gown. If he ignores you and goes into the room, then using the chain of command, the way we set it up in our organization is we don't want staff confronting physicians or other staff members in front of patients, so we have them report that to their supervisor, who immediately reports it to the supervisor of the clinician involved. So if you go to the next slide, which is around engaging all the clinicians, including our physicians, in culture safety work, we really had to be kind of innovative and creative around how we got our physicians involved. Our employed physicians, our hospitalists, our radiologists, our emergency med physicians, our intensivists, they could go through classes with our staff because they were on-site all the time. Many of them were hospital employees, but we had a lot of docs that aren't on-site and really couldn't spend 8 hours in a class. So we devised a 1.5-hour, very fast-paced and very interactive learning session where our physicians had to actually learn something, and then we would stop the verbal interaction and we would get into role-playing, where in many cases they had to play the role of a non-physician. And we used a lot of examples of power gradient and authority, power distance and authority gradient in examples, so that physicians could feel what some of the nursing staff or the transporters or the technicians felt when they are trying to work with them. Safety Culture 102 is our beyond our original curriculum, and this is where we ask physicians to go out and work with their intact work groups or their teams in embedding tools. We supplied them with a library of index cards that had SBAR scenarios on them that were events of harm that occur in the OB population, the physician office practice, down in interventional radiology, the operating room. So we have a whole library of specified SBARs that physicians could use, and we asked them to set up with the nurse managers they worked with these informal training sessions where they could really involve the staff in discussions about the types of errors that either did happen on that unit or something that could be very likely to happen based on an SBAR scenario that they were using, and where they could get informal discussion going. We asked them to bring something nice that made the staff feel like they wanted to acknowledge how important this work was. Some doctors would come with bags of fresh bagels or a bag of apples and some caramels or whatever, you know, they could bring to make the staff feel like this is really an important exercise for us as a team to sit down and informally do the Safety Culture 102 exercises. So we'll skip over the picture, which is just some of the pictures that we took in our role-playing that is part of the physician training, and this is called A Day in the OR. Let's go on to embedding a reliable culture of safety and the things that we did to make our culture change stick or to sustain our gains. If you go to slide number 45, Culture Embedding Mechanisms, this is from the work of Edgar Schein. There's so much of this work about leadership in the literature. And Schein says that in embedding any kind of behavior, desired behaviors, the staff look at what leaders pay attention to, what they measure, how they react to critical incidents in any organizational crisis. So basically they're looking at what leaders promote and what leaders punish and how, what kind of behaviors do leaders role model. Secondary reinforcement mechanisms include stories or dispelling myths, for example, about people and events. So we make sure that when we hear great patient safety stories, we send them out. We also have a patient safety website that is full of our patient safety stories. So if a hospital president or a medical director or a vice president for medical affairs is getting ready to go out and do rounds, if the infection preventionists are getting ready to go do their work with their nursing infection champions, then they actually can get on and they can pull patient safety stories and they can, you know, bring these things with them to meetings so that they have a great way to kick off all of the meetings. If we go on to slide number 46, this is about our safety coaches. So I talked about our infection prevention liaisons. They are very active groups in our hospitals, and we also have safety coaches, and we have quality champions. And so these people are part of our infrastructure that we build at the front line. We have some meetings with them all together, but largely the groups meet with their cohorts quarterly. So the infection preventionists meet with the infection prevention champions quarterly. The patient safety specialists meet with the safety coaches every month, and they actually are expected to do 4 hours per month of coaching and peer checking. And you can see that the list of their accountabilities are here. And our folks who are infection prevention liaisons and safety coaches, it's part of the clinical ladder so that they actually are rewarded at a different level of salary even if they are active in these particular duties. So it's very important that the organization take this seriously and make this part of the infrastructure. We have duties on slide 47 that I'm not going to read, but we have a similar thing for patient safety champions among our medical staff. Slide 48 shows you some pictures of our monthly great catches. So we have many, many great catches that are nominated by anybody on the unit, so they can get on and click on a link on our intranet and immediately get a form to nominate people for a great catch. We have a place where people also put their patient safety success stories. On the next page, I have actually outlined a patient safety success stories. These success stories go all the way up to our board. And we start our board meeting with a couple of patient safety success stories. So we not only have a review of any harm or death that might occur in the organization, but we also make sure that we have time to celebrate the wonderful staff that are out there on the front line every day. The next slide shows that through all of these great catches and safety stories, we are actually able to pull out the error prevention tool that has been used in preventing harm. And we do a lot of calculating of that because it's important that we know that the training didn't end with the classroom time, that these people are actually using the error prevention tools. So when we celebrate them, we also get a chance to reinforce what tools they've used. If you go to the next slide, 51, patient identification using our name and date of birth is the first red rule that Mainline Health put in place for every single employee. And these red rules are so serious that there is a corrective action involved with the breaking of a red rule. The second red rule that we'll be rolling out is active and appropriate participation in timeout in the universal protocol in any area where there is a procedure. So let's go to the results in summary. On slide 53, I simply have our roadmap that walks through where we started with the preparation for our culture change. We did our diagnostic. We developed interventions, which we put in the form of everything from curriculum to starting to do a different method of cause analysis. So our patient safety specialists and those that do, they don't just do root cause analysis now, they do a broader cause analysis. We have our accountability systems that include our safety coach program that is at the front line holding people accountable, and all the methods that we use to hardwire the change, including working with, we have a new interview format where we actually go over with any potential candidate the type of cultural work that they'll be expected to do as a member of Mainline Health. And then I mentioned that it's built, there are aspects built into the performance management so that for yearly appraisals, we have to show some competency with the error prevention tools. So slide number 54 is our journey of reducing preventable harm. We have made an 80% reduction in harm and certainly will not be satisfied until we have no events of harm. We have much, much fewer events that result in death, but all harm, even if it's temporary harm, is very frightening for our patients, and it's part of our elimination of preventable harm. If I had time, I'd show you our graphs for infection prevention, for falls with harm, for mortality related to sepsis, and we have seen statistically significant reductions in all types of preventable harm since we began this journey. So in summary, there are some challenges once you start to see your data looking good. People get rather complacent. They kind of adopt that sort of we fixed it mentality. So we have to work very hard on sustaining our culture change through our embedding tools. And it's unbelievable. We actually have embedding teams at every campus. And those are the kind of people that sign up for, you know, the kind of all the social functions, and they're the people that are on, you know, the awards and recognition committees, but they come up with the most wonderful ways of continuing to embed the safety culture. They have at Halloween, they have pumpkin decorating contests, for example, so that people have to select an error prevention tool, and they have to decorate pumpkins that demonstrate how the pumpkins would be using the error prevention tool. So that's just one example of the many things. At Christmas, they built Christmas trees that were full of error prevention tool kind of designs with really innovative decorations, and then we had a contest where the senior leaders had to walk around and judge the trees. So sustaining this isn't easy, and it's not always fun because we actually have, you know, have to get into corrective action on occasion, but we also have aligned the medical staff accountability or corrective action model. And remember, we're in a community hospital setting with a largely volunteer medical staff. So this has been very hard to get commitment from senior leaders, and they are totally, fully committed in suspending privileges should someone really breach our culture of safety. Recognizing the drift and the constant threat of power distance and authority gradient, which we've dubbed power gradient, is always an issue. So we're doing a walk the talk for patient safety for 3 months, where we will kind of set up like a safety fair with different booths where people will have to play games and actually practice demonstrating not only the tools, but we've built power gradients into all of this to see how people will be able to deal with power gradients. So in summary, safety must be the core value that trumps everything else. Yes, it does start with leaders, but it can certainly start with anyone in the organization willing to call someone on a safety behavior. So don't think because your organization hasn't made a huge commitment that you, all of you on the phone, couldn't be the ones that start the discussions that lead to some transformational change. just culture where everyone is held accountable, but it is not a punitive culture. It's a fair culture, so that the first thing we ask isn't who did it, but how did this happen and how did we fail our employees? Were there systems or processes that weren't there to support them that allowed them to commit an error? And then giving staff the empowerment and the tools to speak up for safety in the presence of what I believe is a power, distance, and authority gradient that exists everywhere is really the most important aspect. So I end with a quote from Albert Einstein: the world is not a dangerous place because of those who do harm, but because of those who look on and do nothing. And so I'll be happy to open for questions.
Well, thank you very much. That was, I want to say, inspiring and exciting. Very often, teleclasses get quite scientific, and I don't get quite as excited as this one. And I was prepared to say, firstly, let me say, I'm glad that your voice held out. You're a little croaky.
Thank you.
I was prepared to say that these things are very interesting, provided that you have the commitment from top management. But in your closing comments, you threw that right back at me by saying that anyone can make a start. If somebody is a nurse in a ward level, how can they make the start?
How can they make a difference? So let me tell you a couple of examples how staff had made a difference in my world, even before we got too deep into, you know, the actual rolling out of the curriculum, which when you think about it, took close to a year and a half to cover over 10,000 people. But as staff started to learn about this stuff, and even before that, once in a while, I'd get a call and they'd say, you know, I work on a unit. I'm not comfortable telling you my name, but I work on a unit where we have a manager who just allows the most unsafe behavior. And our staff is really concerned that someone is going to get hurt. And it actually puts the staff that are doing the right thing into a predicament. So how can you help us? So then my next step is to say, well, I would be happy to meet with you or a group of you to try to help you shape some methods for helping yourselves and for speaking up as a guiding coalition to your manager. And then if that doesn't work, then I'd be happy to figure out how we together will go to the department director. And so lots of times staff will speak up or they will get into trouble. So keeping ears to the ground about staff who have spoken up to someone who's not performing hand hygiene, or they're getting, you know, constantly ignored by people going into the room. So, for example, you don't have to be a part of a big movement that's undergoing it. But if you just took ARC, ask a question, make a request, voice a concern, and use the chain of command. If everyone on the phone said, I'm going to go out there, and in my observations of hand hygiene and my observations of isolation compliance, I'm going to start to pull the staff together and use ARC. And I, the infection preventionist, are going to be a role model, and I'm going to spend some time on the unit and have them point out chronic offenders, and I'm going to go and role play how you would use ARC, and I'm not going to embarrass the offender. I'm going to say, you know what, we're doing something special in infection prevention. We're going to use a tool called ARC. Here's what it is, and I'm going to use you as a role model if you don't mind. Can you do some role play with me? I'm going to ask you a question, voice, you know, make a request, and you literally go through that with isolation. And you, as a frontline infection preventionist, can start to work with your frontline staff on some of this work. You could start a cultural event by just saying, we're going to use two big things to speak up for safety. We're going to use ARC and Stop the Line for infection prevention. And Stop the Line will be that we're going to do education about the bundle compliance for CLABSI, and any time anyone notes that people aren't following every step of the bundle, we're going to say, could we please stop the line? I need clarity. Is this time that we would use the full you know, barrier? And you've got to communicate to everybody, of course, that you're going to do this and try to get everybody on board. But it doesn't take a great big organizational thing where you train 10,000 people. You can start this from the grassroots up. Is that a good answer?
Very good answer. You mentioned that you have some video clip examples of of ARC in action. Are they available to people outside of
I could send you these clips because we at Mainline Health made them, and we at Mainline Health are happy to share them. If you have a site you can post them on, I'd be happy to share a couple of them.
Done. We can certainly do that.
Okay.
Now, speaking of YouTube, I just want to mention to the audience that if you go to YouTube and you do a search under Denise Murphy, you will probably find a video of a talk that she gave there. I'm not sure how long ago that was. I didn't notice what date that was, but I think it was fairly recently. You gave a talk to a group, and it's about an hour long, and it is a really, really good talk.
On YouTube?
Yeah.
I had no idea. I had no idea there was something I did on YouTube. Okay.
Now,
great.
In the last moments, I think we're a little bit over our time, but in the last moments, I'll point out the last two slides that I added. The coming soon slide on slide number 60, there is a change on there. On March 6th, the healthcare laundry epidemiology and microbiology issues with Dr. Lynn C. Hulster, she's asked that we change that to a later date. We haven't, because of health issues in her family. So we have not yet rescheduled that, but it'll likely be perhaps in May. And there will be another teleclass that's not on there yet, but we'll be broadcasting a teleclass live from the German Hospital Infection Control Association conference, which is at the end of March, and that will be posted hopefully within the next few days, certainly by the end of next week, and we will announce that. We might even be broadcasting one of the lectures in German, which is our first ever German teleclass. We do three or four different languages now, but not German. On the very last slide, I would like to acknowledge our patron sponsors. These are the organizations that help us to fund the teleclass education program, and they are very, very good to us. Virox Technologies, Inc., the World Health Organization, and the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology at the University of Ottawa, all very fine organizations, and we thank them very much. Thank you to all of you who have joined us today for what I think is one of our most stimulating lectures ever, certainly in my memory in the last 13 years. And Denise, I want to thank you for giving us that. It's very interesting and very motivating, and I think it will lead to change among hospitals. And I thank you very much.
I hope so. And people have my email address on their slide sets, should there need to be any follow-up.
So thank you to all again.
Sounds like
we'll
a deal.
Talk to you again very soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Thanks, Paul.